Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 133. It's Monday, September 27th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, COVID is still rocking. Nationally, we're still at an average of 2,000 deaths per day, which makes COVID-19 the number one cause of death in the U.S. It's not over yet, people. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update first here. If we look in Lucas County, the average daily number of cases has actually gone down in the last week from 218 per day down to 181 per day, so that's good news. We may be seeing some kind of inflection point with cases. Testing positivity rates also went down a little bit from 14.4% to 13.9%. So at least we're going in the right direction, although we're still very high. Ideally, supposed to get that down below 5%. Testing volume has been level in Lucas County. In Ohio, the testing positivity rate has also gone down to 12.9% from 13.5% the week before, and the testing volume statewide is going down. In U.S., the testing positivity rate is 7.3%, so you can still see that locally in Ohio, we're almost twice as high. And in the U.S., 61% of U.S. counties have a testing positivity rate over 10%. Not good. Still in the thick of it. Okay, well, it's trending the wrong way in long-term care facilities in Lucas County. We moved up to 68 active cases from 41 in the prior week. That's 31 residents and 37 staff in Lucas County long-term care facilities that have active COVID-19 cases. Lucas County schools, we had good news and bad news. The good news is that the number of staff and students decreased somewhat. The bad news is it's still the second highest ever in Lucas County. We went from 66 staff to 51 staff and 379 students to 296 students. So it's still very high, but hopefully that's trending in the right direction. In Ohio, similarly, it moved down slightly, the number of staff, from down to 1,191 staff and just under 8,000 students. Now, I do want to make a correction because last week I cited that that was over 2% of students in Ohio, and that was based, I got the wrong number for the denominator, the number on the bottom of total students. So scratch that, it's actually lower, that's good news. The number I had was way lower than it should have been. But if you look at the estimated number of students that are actually infected in Lucas County, it's probably about 1% of students in the most recent week. That would be assuming that only about 1 out of 3 infections are actually identified. And the number of students that the rate of students that are identified with COVID-19 infections is actually about a third lower in Lucas County than the state of Ohio as a whole. And we're seeing a little bit of progress. We're still not doing very good as far as school-age Ohioans being vaccinated. We got less than 1 in 5 school-age Ohioans fully vaccinated. But this is up from less than 1 in 7 at the beginning of the school year. Making progress slowly but surely. Okay, the University of Toledo has also saw a bump up in cases. It's actually, the cases identified is higher than it was at the beginning of last school year. Not particularly great news. Surveillance testing was also up. 0.9% of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tests. They're testing more than they were last year, which is good. But 0.9% of students that were randomly test were positive. So we're probably looking at, you know, a couple hundred students at the in the UT community that are positive. UT has mandated vaccines, but that only requires proof by November 15th. So it may be a while before that actually becomes a reality. And students can opt out for weekly testing if they don't get vaccinated. Hospitalizations are still rising in Lucas County, although they are leveling off in Ohio. So it seems that nationally, the different waves of epidemic that we're seeing, it's leveling off or going down a little bit in the South, although it's still at incredibly high levels. People that are unvaccinated are still at very high risk, even relative to early in the pandemic. But we're caught in that wave, and it's actually moving farther in the Northeast into well-vaccinated areas. So, you know, this is really, the epidemic is a bunch of little epidemics. We're still in the thick of it, though. Okay, deaths are still rising nationally in Ohio and Lucas County. And as I mentioned before, nationally we've hit that average of 2,000 deaths a day, which puts us nice and solidly as a number one cause of death in the U.S. Okay, vaccination still trudging along, slower than it was a month or two when we were getting hit hard. Still no great surge of vaccinations completed weekly in Ohio or Lucas County. And Lucas County still is lagging behind Ohio in total and per week, the amount of new people that are getting vaccinated. Okay, well, I want to do some more COVID-19 news, although I promise you, switching on a lot more of the show to non-COVID news, and we'll get to that a little bit later. I have not covered the whole booster stuff that much, partly because I think it's getting more attention than its relative importance in the total dealing with this pandemic. But of course, it is an important point. So here's kind of the story in this first wave, because remember, this is just for Pfizer. It doesn't cover Moderna and J&J, which are also putting in data to be analyzed by the FDA and the CDC's advisory committee. But here's the story we have now from the New York Times. CDC chief overrules agency panel and recommends Pfizer boosters for workers at risk. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last Friday overruled a recommendation by an agency advisory panel that had refused to endorse booster shots of the Pfizer COVID vaccine for frontline workers. In a highly unusual move for the director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky aligned CDC policy with the Food and Drug Administration's endorsement over her own agency's advisors. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices last Thursday recommended the boosters for a wide range of Americans, including tens of millions of older adults and younger people at high risk for the disease. But they excluded healthcare workers, teachers, and others whose jobs put them at risk. That put their recommendations at odds with the FDA's authorization of booster shots for all adults with high occupational risk. Dr. Lewinsky's decision was a boost for President Biden's campaign to give a broad segment of Americans access to boosters. The White House had come under criticism for getting ahead of the regulatory process. The CDC statement arrived well past midnight, a sign of a complicated and confusing decision-making surrounding the boosters. The CDC advisors similarly spent 2 days debating who should get boosters and when, and could not agree on whether occupational risk should qualify as a criterion. I am surprised that Dr. Walensky overturned one of the four advisory committee votes today, and I believe others will be as well, said Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, an infectious disease expert at Stanford and the American Academy of Pediatrics liaison to the committee. But the vote for boosters for occupational risk was close, Dr. Maldonado said, and she agreed with Dr. Walensky's decision. This addresses not only waning immunity, but those at high risk of exposure, Dr. Maldonado added. Minutes before Dr. Walensky's statement, Dr. Amanda Cohn, who oversaw the two-day panel of the meeting, tried to prepare the advisors for the director's decision. Dr. Walensky is reversing decision to not recommend use of a booster dose in persons at high risk for occupational or institutional exposure, Dr. Cohn wrote in the email. I am hoping to share this news with you before you see it in the press. Dr. Walensky's decision to go against her own agency's advisors came as a surprise to at least some of her staff members. The CDC director's endorsement of the advisory committee's recommendations is typically just a formality. Hours before her statement, agency insiders predicted she would stick with the usual protocol because doing otherwise would undermine the process and upset the advisors as well as her own staff. But experts outside the CDC said Dr. Walensky may have had no choice but to align herself with the FDA's decision. There's a complexity here because Dr. Walensky was part of the White House announcement on boosters, noted Dr. Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Walensky said providing booster shots to healthcare workers and others who risk contracting the disease on the job would, quote, best serve the nation's public health needs. She approved the panel's decision to endorse third shots for people over 65, patients in nursing homes and other institutional settings, and those with underlying medical conditions. Dr. Walensky's decision revealed the continuing divisions and confusion among federal regulators and outside advisors about how to contain the virus nearly 2 years into the pandemic. Last Wednesday, the Food and Drug Administration authorized booster shots for certain frontline workers, but the CDC's advisors disagreed that the doses were needed for so many healthy people. Whatever the scientific reservations, millions are expected to seek out booster shots. In one recent poll, about three-quarters of vaccinated Americans said they would opt for a booster if the doses were available. State health departments generally follow the recommendations of the CDC, but many Americans were scrambling for boosters even before the FDA's authorization, typically by finding a cooperative pharmacist or by claiming to be unvaccinated. The CDC's advisors acted on what they described, with considerable frustration, as scant research, mulling over conflicting data points that seldom pointed in one direction. In the end, the panel unanimously endorsed booster shots for adults over 65 and for residents of long-term care facilities, who most clearly will benefit. The committee also backed the shots for people 50 to 64 with medical conditions that leave them at risk for severe COVID-19, as well as those 18 to 49 who have certain medical conditions based on an assessment of their individual needs. Only Americans who already have received two doses of the Pfizer vaccine will qualify for booster shots. The panel was not asked to judge whether people who received the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines should receive additional doses, which have not yet been authorized by the FDA. Several experts on the CDC panel nevertheless urged a mix and max strategy, saying that they could see little reason not to offer a Pfizer booster to someone who qualified but had received, for example, the J&J vaccine. Some members warned that delivering multiple rounds of booster shots, available periodically when authorized, would tax an already burdened healthcare system. The CDC panel's guidance followed weeks of internal disagreement and public debate among American health officials and advisors. In mid-August, President Biden announced plans for a booster rollout, but scientists and regulators were quick to point out that there was little research on who might benefit and how the doses should be distributed. The FDA's acting commissioner, Janet Woodcock, said last Wednesday that the agency's authorization would allow for booster doses, quote, in certain populations such as healthcare workers, teachers, and daycare staff, grocery workers, and those in homeless shelters or prisons, among others. But some members of the committee said there was little evidence to suggest that vaccinated teachers and even healthcare workers were at risk of repeated exposure to the virus. The decision reflected fears that such a broad recommendation would effectively throw the doors open to an all-adults booster campaign. My sense was that the committee felt that there was sort of a hole that you could drive a truck through, Dr. Paul Offit, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a member of the FDA's vaccine advisory panel, told reporters at an online briefing last Thursday. Over the 2 days, the panel wrestled with the public's expectations for COVID vaccines, the safety of third doses, and how a booster program would affect nursing home residents. Boosting doses alone would not turn back the pandemic, some scientists noted. Only vaccinating the unvaccinated would do that. We may move the needle a little bit by giving a booster dose to people, said Dr. Helen Talbot, an associate professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University. But she added, the hospitals are full because people are not vaccinated. The advisors also grappled with the lack of clarity on the goal of the vaccines. Should it be to prevent all infections or to forestall severe illness and hospitalization? Many suggested that booster doses could only do the latter, and that trying to thwart all infections was impossible. That reasoning supported limiting who should receive the doses, the expert said. But it was not clear how long additional protection from a booster would last, raising the prospect that boosters would need to be given repeatedly. Boosters can reduce infection in nursing home residents who are among those at highest risk. Even so, cases in nursing homes will persist when community transmission is high, according to a modeling study presented at the meeting. The advisors also wrestled with the practicalities of endorsing a booster shot for only Pfizer when close to half of vaccinated Americans have received Moderna or J&J vaccines. I just don't understand how later this afternoon we can say to people 65 and older, you are at risk for severe disease and death, but only half of you can protect yourselves right now, said Dr. Sarah Long, a pediatrician and infectious disease expert at Drexel University College of Medicine in Pennsylvania. Committee members also expressed concern that some recommendations, particularly that certain younger Americans be allowed booster shots after an assessment of individual risk, would mean that only the wealthy and educated would gain access to additional shots. Some experts seem to suggest that it might be better to hold off on recommending any booster shots until recipients of all three vaccines could qualify for them. Moderna's booster authorization may arrive in a few days to weeks. The company has applied to the FDA for authorization of a booster shot carrying half the dosage given in the first two shots, which has complicated the agency's deliberations. Some global health experts have criticized the Biden administration for pushing booster shots when much of the world has yet to receive a first dose, but analysts noted that even if the United States distributes booster shots, there still should be considerable excess vaccine supply this year, and they urge the government to begin sending the extra doses abroad. Okay, and for a little bit more coverage on this from Stat News, Biden's chaotic messaging on COVID-19 boosters is pitting the White House against government scientific advisors. When the FDA authorized the booster shot, it brushed aside its advisors' recommendation, adding in any American at added risk exposure to COVID-19 like teachers, doctors, or grocery store workers. Days later, the CDC advisory panel also recommended scaling back the Biden administration's plans, recommending the shots only for the 65-plus population. But last Thursday, Walensky disregarded her own advisors, too, ruling that a younger at-risk population could receive the shots as well. More broadly, the administration's disregard for the advisory boards may call into question whether the administration is, quote, following the science, as promised on the campaign trail. It's extremely rare for the CDC to buck its advisory committee's recommendations on vaccine guidelines. It's believed that a CDC director has only deviated from the committee's guidance once before, during a 2003 controversy over how widely the George W. Bush administration should roll out to health workers and first responders a controversial smallpox vaccine that was also linked to a risk of myocarditis and pericarditis. Advisory committee member Sarah Long, who voted against the recommendation that Walensky nonetheless approved, called the move, quote, disheartening in a way. I do not want to do anything now to add confusion to an already confusing situation for the public, said Long, a professor of pediatrics at Drexel University College of Medicine. Having said all that, I want to say that this is almost unprecedented. A surprise would be putting it mildly. Grace Lee, the advisory committee chair, voted for the recommendation that Walensky reinstated. She said the vote was close. Walensky had to make a decision, and it is in her purview to overrule the committee. I respect that she has to make a call that's difficult, and no matter what the call it was that she made, it would have been challenging either way. There was no winning in this situation, honestly, said Lee, a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University School of Medicine. In a statement, Walensky defended the decision, arguing she believed the decision would, quote, do the greatest good, despite the lack of clear data and continued uncertainty. Though she had clearly rejected the advice of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee, the agency attempted to cast Walensky's decision in a different light. The CDC director did not override or disregard the advisory committee. She disagreed with the committee and added the fourth. She agreed with the committee and added the fourth recommendation. This was her decision, and she was not influenced by outsiders, a CDC spokesperson told Stat shortly after Walensky's statement was issued. And while there is more recent precedent for FDA regulators defying their scientific advisors, as happened this year with the controversial approval of an Alzheimer's drug, the administration's actions also represent a contradiction of Biden's longtime campaign pledge that he would defer, quote, to the experts. Well, yes, this is kind of a mess. And of course, as science rolls out and works its way through the regulatory process, it's not going to have anything but a few bumps at least. But to get past some of the confusion, I'm going to do this quick little explainer from the Associated Press. Who's eligible for Pfizer booster shots in the U.S.? Millions of Americans are now eligible to receive a Pfizer booster shot to help increase their protection against the worst effects of coronavirus. A look at the nuts and bolts of this new phase of the vaccination campaign. Who should get the Pfizer booster? People who got Pfizer shots at least 6 months ago and who fall into one of these groups should get the booster. People 65 and older, nursing home residents, and assisted living residents. Others age 50 to 64 with a long list of risky health problems, including cancer, diabetes, asthma, HIV infection, and heart disease. Being overweight or obese is also a category, and this qualifies roughly 70% of the people in this age group, that age group of 50 to 64. Who else can consider getting it? The CDC says these people may get a booster, but stopped short of a full recommendation. People 18 to 49 who got their Pfizer shots at least 6 months ago with risky health problems can consider the booster based on their individual benefits and risks. Anyone 18 to 64 with a risky job, such as healthcare, consider boosters. Prisoners and people living in homeless shelters are also in this group. What if I got Moderna? Can I get a Pfizer booster? Not yet. Health officials say they don't have enough data on the mix and match vaccinations. Moderna has applied to U.S. regulators for its own booster, one that would be half the dose of the original shots. The FDA is considering that application. What if I got J&J? People who originally got the single dose J&J, Johnson & Johnson, also must wait. The government doesn't recommend mixing and matching. J&J hasn't yet filed a booster application, but earlier last week, the company released data showing two doses of its vaccine provided stronger immunity than one, whether the extra dose was given either 2 months or 6 months after the first. Are boosters free? Yes. Shots given under FDA's emergency use authorization are free, and there should be enough supplies. Am I fully vaccinated without a booster? Yes. Two doses of Pfizer or Moderna or one of J&J is still considered fully vaccinated. Why were boosters so hotly debated? The need for boosters is not crystal clear. Studies show the vaccines are still offering strong protection against serious illness for all ages, and many experts want to focus attention on getting shots to the unvaccinated, the group most in danger of infection, hospitalization, and death. On the other hand, there is a slight drop in the vaccine's effectiveness among the oldest adults, and immunity against milder infection appears to wane months after people's initial shots. Protecting healthcare workers from even mild illness may help some hospitals now struggling to care for unvaccinated COVID-19 patients. Are other countries offering boosters? Britain and Israel are already giving boosters over strong objections from the World Health Organization that poor countries don't have enough for their initial doses. And that's kind of the meta argument for all of this, is we got a world that's largely unvaccinated. We're giving third, and actually Israel is giving fourth shots to people. One just other note and reminder is that when they're looking at all this data, really preventing from severe disease is the most important things, but it does seem that our CDC director does seem to be edging towards trying to put a little bit of dent in infection rates. The problem with this is that scientifically, you probably get a boost in your protection from even mild infection or mild disease, but that is probably pretty short-lived. So, who knows, we're coming to flu season, so maybe if it gives you a couple months or so of better protection, that's great. But it probably isn't something that, you know, permanently boosts up your protection from the Delta variant, which seems very good at being able to at least start an infection, although the vaccines are still really, really good at keeping that infection from getting serious enough to put you in the hospital or kill you. Okay, well, whenever you're talking about vaccinations, it's complicated and there's a lot of misinformation out there. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, while some places in the country are overwhelmed with COVID-19 cases in their hospitals and having to triage who they take care of, we have this story from Medical Express. COVID triage standards may worsen racial disparities in treatment. During the crush of the COVID-19 pandemic, overwhelmed doctors and nurses in some places have had to make agonizing decisions about which patients should receive scarce healthcare resources. However, two Yale-led research studies suggest that a standard measurement designed to help predict which patients have the best chance of survival and who therefore should receive treatment could promote racial disparities of treatment outcomes. Okay, well, let's end the COVID-19 storyline here. This from Medical Express with hopefully some good news. Suicide rates fell in Canada during pandemic despite rise in unemployment. The results of research into suicide rates in Canada during the COVID-19 pandemic showed that rates fell despite a simultaneous increase in unemployment. The research says the measures it put in place by the Canadian government to reduce insecurity during the stringent shutdown of the economy offer suicide reduction lessons for governments globally, even after the pandemic has passed. The study, published in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, compared suicide rates in Canada between March 2020 and February 2021 with the same period the year before. The rate was reduced from 10.8 deaths per 100,000 to 7.3 deaths per 100,000. Lead researcher Dr. Roger McIntyre of the Mood Disorder Psychopharmacology Unit of the University of Toronto said, "It was projected that in Canada there would be an increase in completed suicides, or deaths of despair, unless financial provision and social programs, as well as other services including mental health programs, were immediately initiated to specifically address aspects of insecurity, including economics and housing." The researchers describe how the Canadian government provided financial support to employed and self-employed Canadians of $2,000 Canadian every month for up to 28 weeks and $1,250 Canadian to students every month for up to 16 weeks. Leniency on mortgage payments was recommended and there was increased funding for emergency child care provisions. In addition, funding was deployed for emergency psychiatric services in the form of access to 24/7 crisis lines, as well as a provision of psychotherapeutic and counseling services at no charge to Canadian residents. Dr. McIntyre added, "It is noteworthy that the observed decrease in the Canadian suicide rate, alongside an increase in rates of psychological distress, mental illness, and reports of suicidality, reflects the multifactorial and discrete phenomenology of suicide during the COVID-19 pandemic." Okay, that's a pretty big, long, complicated sentence. Basically, what they're saying is that you can actually have rising distress, but you can prevent the worst form of a mental health outcome, which would be suicide, for instance, by having adequate supports in place to prevent the worst outcomes. He concluded, "A national imperative in Canada and globally should be to reduce suicide rates. Government interventions that broadly aim to reduce measures of insecurity, as well as provide social support and timely psychiatric services, should be prioritized as a part of a national suicide reduction strategy, not only during, but after the termination of the COVID-19 pandemic." Well, folks, you're listening to Just for the Health of It. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. On 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Okay, let's get to some non-COVID news. And because of this crazy Texas anti-abortion law, I wanted to start off with some news from the Guttmacher Institute. Proportion of pregnancies wanted later or not at all is decreasing across most U.S. states. Most pregnancies in 2017 were wanted when they occurred or sooner, according to a new Guttmacher report that provides state-specific estimates, regional comparisons, and trends for pregnancy desires across the U.S. states. The estimates show that in the majority of states, the rates of pregnancies that occurred when people did not want to get pregnant fell from 2012 to 2017. Declines in pregnancies that were wanted later or not wanted at all likely prompted overall declines in state-level pregnancy rates during the time period. These findings reinforce evidence and from other research that falling pregnancy rates, not abortion restrictions, were the main drivers of recent declines in the U.S. abortion rate. The report is the latest in Guttmacher's body of work that explores pregnancy intentions. Framing this most recent research in terms of pregnancy desire, how people felt about their pregnancy rather than their intentions, aims to improve understanding of pregnancy experiences in the United States. Key report findings were, in 2017, pregnancies reported as happening at the right time or being wanted sooner when they happened comprised the largest share of pregnancies in nearly all states. There was relatively wide variation across states in the proportion of pregnancies wanted then or sooner, which ranged from 41% in Louisiana and Tennessee to 62% in Utah. From 2012 to 2017, the rates of pregnancies that were wanted later or unwanted fell in at least 30 states. Other research shows that that over roughly the same time period, the national abortion rate fell by 20% from 2011 to 2017. Again, that key finding is that falling pregnancy rates are not based so much on abortion restrictions, but the main driver was actually a decline in unwanted pregnancies. Say yes to family planning. Okay, well, next up from Stat News is a story that really puts in high relief our kind of fixation of pharmaceutical solutions, which does not work very well compared to a broader public health approach. This from Stat News, the brain health paradox. Dementia rates have fallen even as drugs have failed. Billions of dollars have been spent in pursuit of a pharmaceutical treatment for Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Their fail rate through the 21st century is stuck at 100%. The dominant story promoted by Alzheimer's advocacy organizations, pharmaceutical companies, and academic experts is that without a cure, aging societies will face a demographic tidal wave of dementia, a silver tsunami unleashing devastating socioeconomic consequences. Yet dementia rates have actually fallen in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, France, Sweden, and the Netherlands over the past decade, even though biotechnology continues to come up short. A 2020 study compiling data from those six countries from 1988 to 2015 calculated that while the overall number of people affected by dementia is incrementally rising, as would be expected given the growing population of aging individuals, the incident rate of dementia has consistently declined by 13% per decade and by 16% for Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia. And as an editorial note, this is a really important thing when you're looking at absolute numbers versus the rate. So if you look at the age of people, the rate's actually going down when you control for age. But the fact that the population is getting a lot older, even with less Alzheimer's per age, you're actually getting more Alzheimer's just because of an aging population. Okay, how can the dementia tsunami be losing momentum without effective drugs to prevent and treat the illness? And how can countries continue this somewhat paradoxical brain health trend? We believe that looking at dementia through a population health lens provides some answers. Older adults in the countries with increasing dementia risk have cognitively benefited from two types of societal changes linked to overall public health improvements in the 20th century. First, better prevention and treatment of cardiovascular disease. And second, increased access to education. Healthier societies mean healthier hearts and heads. The human brain contains an intricate network of blood vessels, so its health is deeply intertwined with that of the heart and the circulatory system. Nearly 20% of the heart's output delivers oxygen and glucose to the brain. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, and associated metabolic syndrome heart disease, sleep apnea, and other conditions can impair the heart and the extensive network of blood vessels in the vascular system, leading to heart attack, stroke, amputation, and more. When these conditions disrupt the flow of oxygen and nutrients to the brain, it can degrade the health and functioning of the organ and affect the mind. Market improvements in healthcare systems in high-income countries over the course of the 20th century have helped drive down the risk for cardiovascular disease, benefiting millions of aging brains. These improvements don't exist in a vacuum. They are the result of specific political and economic decisions that have improved population health. Since the devastation of the two world wars and the Great Depression in between them, every country in which dementia rates are falling, excluding the United States, has legally obligated the state to extend health care coverage to all citizens. Elders in those countries have enjoyed lifespan access to clinical care, which has been instrumental in managing and preventing vascular diseases. Smoking cessation programs like the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Advertising Act of 1966 and the Public Health Cigarette Smoking Act of 1969 in the U.S. have also been major contributors to better health. In the 1960s, 42% of U.S. adults smoked, compared to only 14% in 2019. The success of these public health efforts in the U.S., Canada, and Western Europe has corresponded with decreased risk of vascular diseases that can elevate dementia risk. Lowering lead levels in the air and water has also been good for the heart and the brain. The U.S. was a global leader in this effort in the mid-20th century. Under the Clean Air Act, first enacted in 1963, lead was gradually phased out of gasoline sold in the country, reducing the environmental burden from this heavy metal, a known neurotoxin and a risk factor for dementia. From vehicle exhaust and dropping collective lead levels in the blood of Americans by more than 80% between the 70s and the 90s. In addition to damaging neurons and synapses at the molecular level, lowering IQ, creating emotional disturbances, and reducing academic achievement, lead exposure is also a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Success reducing lead from the environment also benefited brains and vascular systems of countless citizens across the last 50 years. The other major societal pattern that has helped lower dementia rates, increase access to education, is also a population health success story. One observation nearly all of the multi-country studies showing reductions in dementia risk is a consistent rise in total years of education among older adults. In the U.S., for example, the percentage of adults aged 65 and older with a high school diploma increased from 40% in 1960 to 90% in 2020, and those with college degrees increased from 8% to nearly 37%. These cumulative years of education appear to be now conferring a strong protective effect on dementia risk for millions of people. This finding is consistent with what is known as the cognitive reserve hypothesis, the notion that intellectual stimulation across the lifespan can, through mechanisms that aren't yet fully understood, render the brain more resilient to neuropathologies that accumulate with age. In the U.S., rising education rates for current elders are directly linked to governmental interventions like the GI Bill, which provided subsidies for returning veterans to attend colleges and universities. More than 10 million World War II veterans took advantage of this opportunity, though this benefit was not equally distributed, as black veterans were barred from attending many public universities in the segregationist 40s and 50s. Veterans of subsequent wars continued benefiting from the GI Bill, while the Cold War intensified the expansion and subsidization of colleges. The introduction of Pell Grants in the 1970s expanded enrollment for students in financial need. Thanks to these state interventions between 1945 and 1975, the number of undergraduate students in the U.S. colleges and universities increased fivefold and graduate students ninefold. A tangled road ahead. These positive brain health trends may soon begin reversing due to the reorganization of Western societies over the last several decades around radical free market principles. This bipartisan shift, which is commonly referred to as neoliberalism or market fundamentalism, began in the 1970s in response to the crisis of stagflation and international oil shocks. It has transitioned the government's role from capital control, redistribution, and public investment, as was generally the commitment of Western states during the post-Depression and post-World War II period in the mid-20th century, to facilitating global capital mobility, market expansion and deregulation, decreased taxation of the wealthy, deunionization, and cutting and privatizing public goods and services. As Western states have gradually placed greater faith in the efficiency of markets while reducing public commitments to citizens, the societal conditions of the mid-20th century that had produced a robust middle class, improved public health, and ultimately engineered process progress on dementia that have deteriorated. Whereas cardiovascular disease declined in the post-war period, the U.S. has now experienced a resurgence of chronic disease, with 6 in 10 Americans living with at least one chronic condition. 80 million Americans are either uninsured or underinsured, and millions are coping, or trying to cope, with rising rates of depression, anxiety, and day-to-day financial worry in a deeply unequal, debt-burdened country characterized by declining population health, rising deaths of despair from suicide, overdose, and alcoholism, and falling lifespans. None of this bodes well for brain health, nor does the fact that trends toward increasing years of education are expected to level off for future aging Americans who have faced the barrier of soaring tuition costs in marketized higher education, underwritten by Wall Street. During a 40-year stretch of wage stagnation for the working class, and as has been tragically observed in cities like Flint, Michigan, and in Cleveland, Ohio, which the authors have both called home, the U.S. is dealing with a widespread lead crisis stemming from its aging water pipe infrastructure and the neoliberal austerity policies that have gutted regulatory oversight and cut spending on public goods and public health. Alzheimer's, a heterogeneous syndrome entangled with aging, is not likely curable via single drug approaches. This will probably be the case for other age-related dementias as well. That's why it's critical that we again reorder population-level structures, institutions, and social processes so they benefit the bodies and brains of future generations. A healthier society in which everyone is guaranteed nutritious food, safe drinking water, living wage jobs, safe neighborhoods, quality health care, safe and affordable housing, higher education, and adult learn opportunities. In essence, a renewed 21st century commitment to broader prosperity, public health, and prevention will be the best way to promote brain health and keep the dementia tsunami under control.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up from food politics, we see that a pharmaceutical-driven and fragmented social response to non-communicable chronic diseases hasn't really been working. We got this. At last, a call for leadership to prevent diet-related chronic disease. Chronic non-communicable diseases, heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, account for half of annual deaths in the United States, at enormous physical and economic cost to individuals and to society. These conditions are related to diet. Obesity is a risk factor for all three. Despite the widespread prevalence of obesity, the CDC says 74% of American adults are overweight or severely overweight, and its associated chronic conditions, no concerted government effort is aimed at prevention. Why is so little attention focused on diet-related conditions? To prevent them, people have to eat more of healthier foods and less of unhealthier foods. Public health measures strongly opposed by the food industry. Representatives Rosa DeLauro and Tim Ryan have the same question. They asked the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, to look into government efforts to prevent chronic disease. The result? Chronic health conditions, federal strategy needed to coordinate diet-related efforts. It's not that the U.S. government ignores chronic disease. On the contrary, the GAO identified an astounding 200 federal efforts to reduce these conditions, but fragmented among an even more an astounding 21 federal agencies. Most of these are focused on research. These programs are all over the place, and nobody is in charge. Agency officials say they lack authority to lead a federal strategy on diet. Despite their support for a federal strategy to coordinate diet-related efforts, no agency officials we interviewed asserted that their agencies had the authority to lead a federal strategy that would have reasonable assurance of being sustained across administrations. Officials from 6 agencies said they would not have the authority, and officials from the remaining 10 agencies said they did not know or were not in a position to comment. Some officials stated that they would have the authority to lead a strategy for their agency alone, but not for the entire federal government. The GAO came to the obvious conclusion. Congress should consider identifying and directing a federal entity to lead the development and implementation of a federal strategy to coordinate diet-related efforts that aim to reduce America's risk of chronic health conditions. The strategy should incorporate elements from the 2011 National Prevention Strategy and should address outcomes and accountability, resources, and leadership. Huh. Wow. Leadership. Here's my list. Say what a healthy diet is in plain English. Tell the public to avoid or minimize ultra-processed foods. Establish policies from agriculture to public health to promote healthful diets and discourage unhealthful diets. This will take courage, hence leadership. Okay, folks, well, policy does matter, as shown by this story from Medical Express. Graphic warning labels on cigarettes could have prevented hundreds of thousands of deaths. A child with an oxygen mask, a diseased lung, a woman with a huge bump on her neck. Added warning labels like these with graphic depictions of the negative health consequences of cigarette smoking could have averted thousands of smoking-related deaths if approved as originally planned in 2012, according to a new analysis by University of Michigan researchers and colleges from the Cancer Intervention and Surveillance Modeling Network. While the FDA had planned to implement the graphic warning labels 9 years ago, it has been entangled in litigation with the tobacco industry over the issue. The rules to add the labels include textual warnings and color graphics with photorealistic images depicting the negative health consequences of cigarette smoking, such as warnings that smoking can cause erectile dysfunction or head and neck cancer and can lead to COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Industry litigation and delays to implementing tobacco regulations have high cost to public health, said Rafael Meza, professor of epidemiology and global public health at U of M School of Public Health, U of M meaning U of Michigan, of course, and senior author of the study. This research shows that we must move forward with implementation to maximize the benefits of adding graphic health warnings to cigarettes packaging. The researchers acknowledge that while literature on graphic health warnings demonstrates their public health benefit, uncertainty remains about the true magnitude of their effect on smoking behavior, especially with regard to smoking initiation. If the warnings had been implemented in 2012, researchers estimate about 365,000 to 1,060,000 deaths might have been prevented, and 5.7 to 16.6 million life years could have been gained. More than 120 countries have required graphic health warnings on cigarette packs and saved lives by doing so, said the study's first author, Jamie Tan, an assistant professor at the Yale School of Public Health. The U.S. has been lagging behind the rest of the world when it comes to this issue, so we are long overdue, she said. I would just give one, this is a really cool article. Of course, it's a model. You know, you can't know what the alternative reality would be if they'd actually pass that. But I think it is. I think it is valid. The one thing I would comment, though, is we know that in health education and health behavior, that actually these graphic warnings, in and of themselves, scaring people, doesn't really have a huge effect on people. But I think the big difference it makes here with tobacco products is that when you basically take up the whole space of the product, you don't allow other forms of branding. And also these things require like the same font, no colors, all this kind of stuff. So really what you take out of is a differentiation and a branding effect that you get. So you wipe out that positive aspect that tobacco companies are able to do. So that probably in of itself has as large effect as perhaps. And people should be obviously made aware of all the many negative effects of cigarette smoking and any kind of tobacco use. But yeah, so hey, there's another hundreds of thousands of deaths that the tobacco companies have inflicted on us by tying up this proposed legislation for years and years. Okay, I want to switch gears a bit and go to some environmental and climate change issues. This from Medical Express. Health experts urge nations to implement ambitious air pollution reduction policies. Health experts and patient representative groups have issued a joint statement urging nations to implement ambitious clean air policies without delay in order to protect health. The statement by the European Society of Cardiology and 100-plus partners highlights their support for the recently published World Health Organization Global Air Quality Guidelines, which health experts say should be used as a guide for effective air quality and emission reduction policies around the world. Professor Stephen Achenbach, president of the European Society of Cardiology, said, "Air pollution is one of the most underestimated causes of heart disease and stroke. Measures to reduce its detrimental impact on cardiovascular and overall health are urgently needed. We welcome the new World Health Organization guidelines and join other societies today to demand ambitious clean air policies without delay." Professor Zorana Anderson, chair of the European Respiratory Society and Health and professor in environmental epidemiology at the Department of Public Health, University of Copenhagen, Denmark, said, "Air pollution poses a great risk to human health. It is linked to major lung and heart diseases, diabetes, cancer, infant mortality, and emerging evidence points to harmful effects on pregnancy, cognitive development in children, dementia, and mental health, as well as an increased risk of dying from COVID-19. As more than 95% of the world's population is exposed to hazardous level of air pollution every day, air pollution ranks fourth among the major risk factors for global disease and mortality. And the estimated global economic cost of pollution-related health effects was $5 trillion in 2013. Reducing air pollution will not only lead to enormous and immediate improvements in the health and quality of life of all citizens, but it will help to lower the medical costs borne by society for the treatment of air pollution-related diseases. Moreover, policies aimed at reducing air pollution will simultaneously reduce emissions of greenhouse gases and help mitigate the unprecedented climate change crises." And on that note, from the Washington Post, some good news. Greenhouse gases in grocery freezers are more powerful than carbon. The EPA now aims to slash their use. The Biden administration finalized its first new climate rule last Thursday, slashing the use of powerful greenhouse gases widely used in home refrigerators and air conditioners and often found to be leaking from U.S. supermarket freezers. The regulation from the Environmental Protection Agency establishes a program to cut the use and production of chemicals known as hydrofluorocarbons by 85% over the next 15 years. Curbing these super pollutants is a rare climate issue with broad bipartisan support. When emitted, the chemicals can warm the planet at a rate hundreds to thousands of times higher than carbon dioxide. The new rule implements a law passed by Congress last year. Over the coming years, the new launch program will bring big changes, by the way, to the way numerous products that today rely on hydrofluorocarbons, including fire extinguishers, aerosol canisters, and building insulation, are made. By 2050, the program will cut nearly the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions as 3 years worth of pollution from the U.S. power sector, federal officials project. Hydrofluorocarbons were once an environmental solution, not a problem. They replaced other chemicals that, when released into the atmosphere, eroded the Earth's protective ozone layer. But their heat-trapping properties still exacerbated global warming. 5 years ago, world leaders signed the Kigali Amendment, an update to the 1987 Montreal Protocol, to rein in these super pollutants. If fully met, the treaty is expected to prevent up to a half degree Celsius of warming by 2100. But President Donald Trump never submitted the treaty for Senate ratification, and his administration rolled back Obama-era policies aimed at meeting the nation's commitments under Kigali. Biden promised to send the treaty to Capitol Hill just after taking office, but has yet to do so, even as China and India ratified it this year. Senator Thomas Carper, Democrat from Delaware, chairman of the Senate Environmental Public Works Committee, urged Biden to send the treaty as soon as possible. "There's no reason to delay ratification," he said. This week, the EPA also proposed a separate rule requiring manufacturers to control, capture, and destroy a particularly potent manufacturing byproduct called HFC-23 that is more than 12,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over the course of the century. And in mid-October, the EPA will act on 13 petitions from green groups, companies, and left-leaning states to further restrict the use of hydrofluorocarbons in a range of appliances, including dehumidifiers and commercial refrigeration equipment. And from Science Daily, showing that everything is interrelated, systems approach helps assess public health impacts of changing climate environmental policies. A team co-led by Washington State University scientists offers an alternative way to understand and minimize health impacts from human-caused changes in the climate environment in a new study published in the journal One Earth. The health consequences of air pollution, climate change, and transformations in agriculture are often discussed separately, but these issues are all related. They have similar sources, and each one affects the others. Agricultural activities contribute to air pollution and affect regional climate patterns, while farm production and quality of crops are sensitive to air quality and climate conditions. Our work sheds new light on the ways that food systems affect and are affected by climate change and air pollution. The scientists reviewed multiple examples of health impacts from changes in climate, air quality, and agricultural output, as well as co-benefits and unintended consequences of efforts to curb emissions and to save water, for example. They found these examples share the need for better tools and local high-resolution data on health, weather, emissions, air pollution, and land use to better measure human and environmental impacts. And to go even more broadly with climate change and health and social outcomes, this from the Associated Press. Leaders to UN. A warmer world is a more violent one, too. Using apocalyptic images, three presidents and seven foreign ministers warned last Thursday that a warmer world is also a more violent one. At a ministerial meeting of the Security Council, the officials urged the UN's most powerful body to do more to address the security implications of climate change and make global warming a key part of all UN peacekeeping operations. Michael Martin, Ireland's president who chaired the meeting, said climate change is, quote, already contributing to conflict in many parts of the world. And Vietnamese President Nguyen Phuc said climate change is a war without gunfire, so to speak, that causes economic damage and losses in lives no less dire than actual wars. The effects of climate change are particularly profound when they overlap with fragility and past or current conflicts, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And when natural resources like water become scarce because of climate change, grievances and tensions can explode, complicating efforts to prevent conflict and sustain peace. Look at almost every place where you see threats to international peace and security today, and you'll find that climate change is making things less peaceful, less secure, and rendering our response even more challenging, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said. He cited a list of nations including Syria, Mali, Yemen, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. We have to stop debating whether the climate crisis belongs in the Security Council, Blinken said, and instead ask how the Council can leverage its unique powers to tackle the negative impacts of climate on peace and security. Okay, we'll end the environmental series here from this from Counterpunch. A little radiation is not good for you. In a rare pushback against the radioactive pollution industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, well known as a rubber stamp for the nuclear lobby, has flatly rejected an attempt to further weaken the agency's radiation exposure regulations. After 6 years of deliberation, the NRC's three commissioners, two Democrats and one Republican, voted unanimously to reject formal petitions submitted in 2015, urging the agency to adopt a cost-cutting scheme known as Hormesis, which claims that, quote, a little radiation is good for you. The September 16 decision by the NRC says, threshold theory posits that there is some threshold dose below which there is either no radiation-related health detriment or a radiation-related health benefit that outweighs any detriment. The order then rebukes this concept, finding the petitioners fail to present an adequate basis supporting the request, and convincing as evidence has not yet demonstrated the existence of a threshold below which there should be no effects from exposure to low radiation doses. At long last, at least in this case, the NRC has decided not to make radiation matters worse. Okay, well, the last story I want to do is a little bit more positive, a little more practical. This from Science Daily. Is your child a fussy eater? While picky eating is all part of the norm for developing toddlers, when it extends into school years, it takes a toll on all involved, children and parents alike. Reviewing 80 health studies, the research found that a range of factors contributing to a child's likelihood of being a fussy eater. The study found that pressuring a child to eat, offering rewards for eating, very strict parenting all negatively influence fussy eaters. Conversely, a more relaxed parenting style, eating together as a family, and involving a child in the preparation of food all reduce the likelihood of fussy eating. Eating together as a family with siblings and having a single meal at a regular time all help to reduce food fussiness, as did getting the fussy child involved in the meal, either by helping to choose the menu or helping to prepare the meal. Yet if fussy eaters are allowed to eat in front of the TV, or if they are rewarded for eating certain foods, these behaviors negatively influence picky children. Yet it's important to understand that being overtly anxious or worried can actually contribute to increased picky eating. Avoiding getting cross and limiting any negativity around mealtime will benefit everyone. Positive parenting, no matter how difficult it can be in certain situations, is the best step forward for fussy eaters. Top tips for helping a fussy eater? 1. Set a good example. A family that eats together has better eating habits. 2. Schedule regular meal times. Regular meal times reduce levels of stress. 3. Get kids involved with food preparation. Familiarity and a sense of control can help. 4. Try to have one meal time. A separate kids sitting encourages fussy eating. 5. Turn off the TV. Focus on food, not on screens. 6. Try to keep mealtimes calm and stress-free. Will be a better experience for all. 7. Remove rewards or bribes or punishments for fussy eaters. Okay, well, I've got an interesting combination of bonus articles that can be found online. I'll give the link at the end. Got 8 articles this week. First up, novel chemical entities. Are we sleepwalking through a planetary boundary? Whew! We have 120,000 man-made chemicals. Most of them are never evaluated. 2. A black town's water is more poisoned than Flint's. In a white town nearby, it's clean. This happens to be a nearby neighbor in Benton Harbor, Michigan. 3. Health equity tourists. How white scholars are colonizing research on health disparities. 4. Conflicts of interest in medical commentaries undermine credibility of major journals. And 5. Saying person with schizophrenia, not schizophrenic, can affect clinician beliefs. 6. Addiction Evidence Project, taking action to strengthen Ohio's addiction response. 7. Autopsies on hold, why we need more medical examiners, an interesting shortage of public health workers. And last but not least, a fun one, 8. Forget nose spray. Good sex clears a stuffy nose just as effectively and is a lot more fun. You can read these and others and all the stories that I covered this episode on toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-